When I suggested Mary Jo Nye as our reviewer for Walter Isaacson's Einstein, His Life and Universe, I knew she was an expert in history of science, but I wasn't aware of exactly how perfectly suited she is to reflect on this particular book for us. You may know that Mary Jo is Horning Professor of the Humanities and Professor of History at OSU in the History Department. Well, that is until about the end of this week. She's just about retiring and will become Professor Emeritus. Mary Jo specializes in the history of chemistry and physics since the 18th century, including political activities of scientists and philosophy of scientists. So I suspect she knows a thing or two about Einstein. I wondered how she became interested in the field of history of science, and it turns out that she began her academic career with a bachelor's degree in chemistry. Mary Jo has authored books and essays about the progress of science and scientists, including our own OSU, we like to claim, Linus Pauling. She's even recently published an essay whose title asks the question, Scientific Biography, History of Science by Another Means. She has been recognized with very high honors for her work from both the disciplines of science and history, and she seems to me the ideal person to talk to us about this particular book. Mary Jo?
Thank you very much, Connie, and thank you, Deborah, for inviting me here.
I think it's one you have to get up pretty close to.
Okay.
So let's just put it right in your face. Oh, dear.
Well, maybe I should hold it.
Actually, this would be fine. How's that?
Can you hear me now?
No?
No?
A little closer.
No. How about now?
Yeah.
Does that make a difference? I'll just hold this.
We'll just get this out of your way then.
Yeah. That made me. I'm delighted to be here, and I was very, very honored and pleasantly surprised when Connie invited.
Can you use your remote microphone might work better? It just
can't. This was not working.
Not very good.
How odd. Is it working now?
Yeah.
That's really close. Okay, we'll do it that way. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you about this book. Let me ask, and it's very nice, too, to see some friends here and some faces that are familiar and faces of friends. It's nice to see many of you. Let me ask, first of all, how many of you have read the Isaacson book? I'm just sort of curious. One, Jean, two, and three. Okay. So, I mean, that's good for me to know. And perhaps I can encourage you to read the book because as I told, when Connie contacted me some months ago to ask if I would do this, I told her that I had not yet read the biography by Isaacson, and I wasn't quite sure what I would say, and I wasn't sure from some comments that some colleagues of mine had made, not on this campus but elsewhere, that I would like the book because I had heard a couple of negative things about it. But I'm glad to say that, in fact, I like the book a great deal, and I would recommend it as a very good read. I don't know what Gene thinks about it. Maybe he'll say later. This is the book. It is a pretty big book, and I don't think it's... Is it out in paperback? I should have checked. It is a paperback now. And, I mean, it's one of these huge biographies, but it reads rather quickly. I did make up some handouts, and I hope... Most of you have copies. Perhaps all of you don't have a copy. But this may be helpful to you both while I'm talking about the book and also just for future reference. There's a two-sided handout, and the two-sided handout lists some sort of pertinent facts about Albert Einstein. And some of this I may end up talking about, some of it I may not end up talking about. But this is a chronology. And this particular handout, except for the first part that lists some places that Albert Einstein lived and some of his close friends and members of his family. Other than that first listing, most of the two-sided handout has to do with Einstein's scientific work, which, after all, is what really made him who he is and was the most important thing to him about his life. And that certainly includes his family. His work was much more important to him than his family. There's another handout, which is just a one-page handout. And what I did on this was to begin with Walter Isaacson's biography, The Einstein, His Life and Universe, that appeared in hardback in 2007, and then to include a few other biographies of Einstein, and then some additional works below that about Einstein. And I just call your attention to begin with to some of these other biographies, because I want to talk about biography and what I'm going to say to you initially. Isaacson's and Jürgen Neffe's biography, which first appeared in German and has now been translated into English, both appeared in 2007. Abraham Pice, I'll mention in a few minutes, is his biography appeared in a second edition in 2005. A first edition had appeared earlier. But I've listed a few other biographies in reverse chronological order. One by Banish Hoffman, who was a collaborator of Einstein's at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Another by Ronald Clark, a great biographer who wrote many biographies, not only of Einstein. Philip Frank, who was a colleague of Einstein in Germany and who knew him quite well, as Hoffman did, and who wrote what I think is a really, really fine, although some would now say old-fashioned, biography of Einstein in 1947. The other two biographies I've listed are less well-known. One of them, by Anton Reiser, was written, in fact, by Rudolf Kaiser, who was Einstein's son-in-law and married Einstein's stepdaughter. And so this was a biography by a family member. The other biography that I've mentioned on this list is by Alexander Moskovsky. This is the first biography of Einstein that was ever written. And note that the date of it, for those of you who have the sheet, is roughly 1920 in the German version, 1921 in the English translation. And what's interesting about that, if you think about it, is that Einstein was still quite young. He was born in 1879. He was not only young, but he was also quite alive when that biography was written. And it was the first biography to be written of him. He had some misgivings about having the biography written of him at the time. But it turned out that it did not cause some of the difficulties he feared it might cause when it was published. So that's the very first biography, 1921, and Isaacson's at the top is one of the most recent biographies. And then below this, I've listed some other sources that you might find interesting if you do want to read and know more about Einstein. Now, this biography that I'm talking about by Isaacson came out in 2007. It just missed by 2 years, and the year 2005. 2005 was a very special year in Einstein's studies because it was the centennial 2005 of the publication in 1905 of 5 papers by Albert Einstein that made his reputation. And the year 1905 has been called the Annus Mirabilis, the miraculous year, for Albert, not only for Albert Einstein personally, but also for physics. And in fact, 2005 was designated as the World Year of Physics, as well as the Einstein Centennial Year. And the Annus Mirabilis designation had to do with 5 papers, all of which appeared in a German physics journal called the Annalen der Physik in 1905. And the 5 papers that Einstein published in that year are, I think, famously known as papers that he wrote and published while he was working in Switzerland in Bern in a patent office. And people often say, well, there was Albert Einstein, someone who was an amateur, who wrote these incredible papers that made his reputation and changed all of physics. Of course, the story is not quite that simple. It's true he was working in a patent office, but he was working in a patent office because of his training in electrical engineering at one of the preeminent European universities or institutes for technology, actually then and now, the Zurich Polytechnic Institute. And the Zurich Polytechnic Institute, where Einstein did his, I guess what you would call his undergraduate work, is a world-caliber MIT or Caltech. I mean, an institution of world renown at that time and now, too. And Einstein studied there electricity and electrical theory. And the reason he got the job at the patent office is because of his expertise in electromagnetism and electrical theory. And while he was at the patent office in this job, he then finished his doctoral dissertation, and then he finished what in Germany still is a second qualification that's called the Habilitationsschrift, which is a kind of second doctoral dissertation that you have to finish as well as take oral exams in order to be qualified to teach in the university. And so at the time he was at the Bern Patent Office, he had not yet finished the qualifications to teach in a university, so it's not surprising he wasn't teaching in one. Like a lot of people, he was working while he finished his degree. And he, as he was writing during this period in the Patent Office in 1905, the papers that he published in the Annalen der Physik had to do with I guess you could say three main categories of work. Two of the papers had to do with what came to be called the special theory of relativity. And of those two papers that had to do with what came to be called the special theory of relativity, one expressed the relationship that later became the famous equation, E equals mc squared, that in 1905. Also in 1905, he published two papers that had to do with what one would call molecular kinetic theory, a theory of matter, and a theory that matter is made up of particles. And the papers he published had to do with the size of particles, the speeds with which they travel, the numbers of particles that one can calculate under certain circumstances. And this was work that, whereas the so-called special relativity papers had to do with electrodynamics and electromagnetic theory, the other two papers having to do with molecular kinetic theory are part of thermodynamics. The fifth paper he published in 1905 had to do with radiation and was Einstein's application in 1905 of a brand new theory that had only been published in 1900, that was not yet well known, and that was not even properly appreciated yet by its author, Max Planck, in terms of its revolutionary potential. That theory was called a quantum theory, and Max Planck had first developed it in 1900. It had to do with radiation, and what Einstein did in his 1905 paper as a young man was to, 26 years old, was to take Planck's idea and apply it in a way that Planck had not to light and to make an argument that instead of thinking of light as everyone thought of it over the whole course of the 19th century as a wave disturbance, sort of like sound but different from sound, but a wave disturbance that is characterized obviously by wavelength and by frequency and has those kind of characteristics, that one would benefit from also thinking of light as having particle-like characteristics. And that there is in the nature of light something that is characterized by discrete or quanta of bundles of energy, and that one needs to actually think of light in this way, a kind of double-sided way, light both as a particle and as a wave. So that was his fifth paper of that year. Now, it was called the Annus Mirabilis in a comparison to a famous series of papers that Isaac Newton wrote in 1665-1666. And in that brief period of time, a period of about 18 months, Isaac Newton in the 17th century is often said to have laid the foundations for modern physics, which Albert Einstein then is said to have called into question in 1905. And in that earlier period, in the 17th century, Isaac Newton, as a young man, also in his 20s, like Albert Einstein, worked on mathematical theory that came to be called the calculus. He worked on himself on a new theory of light that was a very important new theory of light. And he worked on the fundamental foundations of gravitational theory. And he did all that in a very brief period of time. The term annus mirabilis, miraculous year, was used, in fact, by John Donne, the English poet, in a poem that he published in 1665 when he commemorated the victory of the English fleet over the Dutch and the survival of London through a terrible fire of that period. And so the term, you know, it's often used, and in fact, some of you may remember that Queen Elizabeth used the term after considerable misfortunes during her reign to refer to one year as her annus horribilis, her horrible year. And that's simply a play upon this very familiar term, at least in England, of the annus mirabilis. In any case, 2005 was the centennial year of Einstein's great achievement as a young man of 26 in 1905. And in preparation for 1905, centennial, lots and lots of people in the early 2000s were writing biographies of Albert Einstein. Lots of conferences were planned. The year 2005 itself was one in which there were Einstein celebrations all over the world. And books, many, many books came. I mean, there are always lots of books about Einstein, but many came out just at that point. For example, in 2005, among the books that came out was one by John Rigdon, a physicist, another by John Stachel, a physicist. There was a book that some of you may see in the bookstores by Alice Calapris called The Quotable Einstein that has to do with lots of Einstein's aphorisms and famous phrases. There was also a book by Dennis Overby, who writes for the New York Times, called Einstein in Love. And another book by Roger Highfield and Paul Carter called The Private Lives of Albert Einstein. And I'll come back to this in a minute. And Isaacson's book came out a couple of years later, but it differed from the books that came out in 2005 because Isaacson had available to him in 2006 some papers that only had been opened up by the Einstein archives in 2006. So his biography, along with Jürgen Neffe's, differs from others that are, you know, also very new by having access to those papers that I'll get back to in a minute. Now, who is Isaacson? What are his qualifications for writing this biography? Walter Isaacson is a journalist. He's a journalist. He was born in New Orleans. He went to Harvard as an undergraduate. And then he was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. While he was in England, he did some work for the Sunday Times, the London newspaper. And then when he came back to the United States, he worked briefly for the Times-Picayune, the famous newspaper in New Orleans. In 1978, Walter Isaacson went to work for Time magazine. And he worked there for many years, becoming the managing editor, the 14th managing editor in 1996. In 2001, Isaacson became the CEO at CNN. And Isaacson now is the CEO for the Aspen Institute, which is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and, of course, has a beautiful facility in Aspen. And the Aspen Institute, as some of you likely know, is an institution that's particularly interested in issues of leadership and the qualities and virtues of leadership and the making of public policy. So Walter Isaacson is someone who is a journalist, who's had a lot of experience in writing. He's also someone who has, for many years, been interested in the notion of great leaders. He wrote a biography that some of you might have read on Henry Kissinger. Anybody looked at that? 1992. He then wrote a book, which he co-authored with some Evan Thomas, called The Wise Men, Six Friends and the World They Made. And that's a book about
Dean Acheson, Avril Harriman, George Kennan, and other leaders in American foreign policy and American government. There were several biographies of Benjamin Franklin that came out in the early 2000s. Edmund Borgen's is one that's particularly gotten praise, but also has a biography by Walter Isaacson of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, like Albert Einstein, is someone who was a great political figure as well as a very important scientist. And I mean a very important scientist because Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century not only had a reputation in the United States, but he had a reputation in France and in England and an international reputation, particularly in electrical theory, not unlike Einstein. Now, Isaacson, in writing this book, has a sort of obvious difficulty in the sense that he himself is not trained as a physicist and has had very little scientific training. And I was very interested to try to figure out just how he went about writing this then, given the fact that so much of Einstein's work is 20th century physics and not entirely sort of just easy to pick up. So I'd call your attention to the acknowledgments section in Isaacson's book at the very beginning, where he says something that in a way is sort of unusual. I'm going to give you some names, and then I'll explain to you what these names mean. At the beginning of the book, he says the following. Diana Buchwald read the book. Tilman Sauer also checked and annotated this book and vetted sections on Einstein's quest for equations of general relativity and unified field theory. Barbara Wolf at the Einstein Archives at Hebrew University fact-checked every page of manuscript. Brian Green, whose name you may know, physicist at Columbia University, who's done a lot of public television programs. Brian Green talked me through numerous revisions and read the final manuscript. Lawrence Krauss, whose names you also might know, physicist at Case Western Reserve University, vetted special relativity, general relativity, and cosmology in the book. Douglas Stone, a physicist at Yale, helped me on the light quantum paper of 1905, quantum theory, Bose-Einstein statistics, and kinetic theory. Murray Gell-Mann, a Nobel Prize winner, edited and corrected relativity and quantum mechanics, and helped draft sessions explaining Einstein's objections to quantum mechanics. Arthur Miller, Sylvester Gates, John Norton, Jürgen Rinn, Michael Janssen, Gerald Holton read my book and made comments. And Gerald Holton and Dudley Hirschbach sat down with me, he says, in Gerald Holton's office at Harvard to go over the manuscript. Now, Isaacson is someone who did not hesitate to get help when he needed it. It is very striking. And as I read through the book, and as I've talked to a couple of other people who read through the book who know the physics a lot better than I do, they've all been rather impressed with what you find in the book, that it's really quite reliable. And it's in some it's very clear. The explanation of the physics is very, very good. And part of the reason it's very, very good, I imagine, is that Isaacson must have asked these people who really know the physics to explain things to him so that he would understand it, so that he would be able to write clearly, or he actually had them write it. And they did the drafts, and then he went through and corrected a little bit for style and that sort of thing. It's very impressive. And these names that I've read out to you probably don't mean much to a lot of you, but for me as a historian of science, they mean quite a lot. These people are physicists and historians of physics who are the absolute pinnacle in the field. These are important people who really know their stuff. And they're well-connected, and they're sort of the creme de la creme. Many of them, either as physicists or as historians of physicists, are part of what I call, without any sense of mockery, the Einstein industry. There's a Benjamin Franklin industry, there's a Charles Darwin industry, there's an Einstein industry. There's a huge interest, just look at this room, in Einstein for a lot of very good reasons. And there are a lot of people who, in their own interest in Einstein, have written about him. They've written technical articles. They've written popular articles. They've written books. They've written all kinds of things. This is partly possible because Albert Einstein had a sense of who he was. And he had that sense of who he was from the time he was very, very young. In some ways, we can compare him to our own, let's call him our own Linus Pauling, who, like Einstein, left an enormous amount of correspondence, unpublished writings, drafts, second drafts, third drafts, correspondence with publishers, a lot of very important papers and a lot of trivial papers, diary entries, notebook entries, all this sort of stuff. We have that for Einstein, too. When Einstein died, he was in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study, which is not part of Princeton University, but is an independently, privately funded and endowed institution in Princeton. It was formed in 1933, and Einstein was one of its first and its most luminous stars. Einstein he was forced out of Germany, but his family, he was not actually in Germany at the time that two of his houses were basically confiscated, but his family was able to take all of his papers and to get them shipped out of Germany and sent to England. And they eventually followed him to the United States. In addition, there were all his own papers. Now, when he died, when Albert Einstein died in 1955, the two executors for his will were his secretary, Helen Dukas, who had gone to work for him in 1928 in Berlin, and Otto Nathan, who was an economist who had been at Princeton in the mid-1930s. And as executors of his will, they controlled, among other things, all these papers. The papers were at Princeton University for a while, and then they went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem. However, copies remained at Princeton, and then another set of copies ended up at Boston University, and that huge set is now at Caltech. Now, what's the reason for that? Very soon after Einstein's death, there were lots of people who wanted to look at the papers and who had to get permission to look at them. And then the project was conceived of publishing all of his unpublished papers and all of his unpublished correspondence. And that project has been ongoing with John Stachel, the first editor at Boston University, and then with Diana Buchwald, whose name I mentioned earlier, as the present editor, who took over the project from John and now has it at Caltech. They have published, and I have this listed on your handout, they've now published 10 volumes of Einstein's papers, and it's being published in two series. One series are unpublished writings, and the other is the correspondence. And what's remarkable about the correspondence is that the Einstein Project for publication of the papers not only has what Einstein received from correspondence, but it also has what Einstein wrote, partly because sometimes there are carbon copies and that kind of thing, or first drafts of what he wrote, but also because the project is so big and the Einstein industry is such a network that is a cooperative network that people who received Einstein's letters have made copies and sent them to the project, first at Princeton, then at Boston, now at Caltech. So we have an enormous amount of information about Einstein. I mentioned that this biography makes use of papers that were not available until 2006. That's because it was only in 2006 that the Einstein Archives, which has the original set of papers, which is in Jerusalem, opened up and sent copies to Caltech of some papers that were letters that were exchanged between Albert Einstein and his first wife, Mileva Marek, and his two sons, Hans Albert, who later became an engineer and finished his career at the University of California at Berkeley, and Einstein's other son, Edward, who suffered from mental instability and who died in an asylum in Switzerland. And that correspondent had not been opened up before. Isaacson is very much interested in personal aspects of biography, in family relationships and that kind of thing. And so he makes a lot of use of those papers. In addition, there were papers that John Stachel discovered in 1986 that were not part of the Einstein archives originally. In other words, were not part of the papers that Einstein had left in Princeton when he died that were taken over by his executors. The 1986 papers were a group of 400 letters that were in a safe deposit box in a bank in Santa Rosa, California, that were controlled by the second wife of Einstein's son, Hans Albert. And those papers had been taken by Hans Albert's first wife from Switzerland when Albert Einstein's first wife, Mileva Marek, died in 1948. And those papers were taken at that time and ended up in California. And those papers became very, very famous right after they became known in 1986. And many of you probably know about this, because those were papers that were mainly correspondence between Albert Einstein and Mileva Marek before they were married and after they were married. And what those papers revealed, which changed a lot of the reflection upon Einstein as a person, is that Einstein and Mileva Marek, who both were students at Zurich Polytechnic, and again, she is, we would say, Serbian. She was from a little town, Novi Sad, just north of Belgrade. She was a student at this engineering institution, Zurich Polytechnic, at the end of the 1890s. Very unusual, very talented, bright woman. And she and Albert met, and they started seeing a great deal of each other and going on trips together. And as the letters revealed, she was pregnant. She got pregnant. And they weren't married. And at that point, he didn't propose. They got married. His mother didn't like her. He didn't like Maria, Mileva, rather. And she had, well, in any case, they didn't get married. She went home and had the baby. And she wrote Albert Einstein that the baby was a girl. And they named her Lisa Rell. And a lot has been written now about Lisa Rell, and a lot has been written about Mileva Marek. And a lot of people looking at this correspondence that people were just seeing for the first time after 1986 said, well, look, you know, they're not talking just about their personal lives, they're talking about physics. And Walter Isaacson, I mean, does a very good job of treating all this. And yes, they were talking about physics. They were talking about their classes. They had some of the same instructors in common. They were talking about their exams. They were very concerned because she ended up failing her exams and then taking them a second time, failing them a second time, so she never finished her degree. But a lot of people then said, my goodness, you know, maybe she should have been the co-author of these papers of 1905. Maybe her name should be on them because, look, they were talking about this and they were talking about that in their correspondence. And I think that after a lot of examination of the papers, the letters, the consensus is that she was a sounding board, that they were students together, that they talked a lot about their physics, but that the ideas and the implementation of the ideas in the papers were his. But in any case, they were very close, and she was very important to him. However, it is true that his daughter, Lisa Rell, was never important enough to him that he visited her. So after the baby was born, he didn't try to see her. And then it seems, as many of you may have read, that she either was adopted or she died, and it's not clear. No one knows what happens to Lisa Rell. If you go on the web, I'm sure you can find one cockamamie story after another about, you know, where Lisa Rell is and what happened to her and all that kind of thing. But you know, people who have studied this in a scholarly fashion, in fact, haven't been able to turn up anything, nor have what's left of the family. In any case, they did get married, and then they had two children after that, first Hans and then Edward. And a lot of people, you know, were very interested in this side of Einstein's life and made a great deal of the fact that he had a liaison and that he had an illegitimate child whom he never really knew. Isaacson does a good job of covering that and discussing it. Isaacson also, in this biography, more than any other book, there are a couple of books I mentioned to you earlier that I put on the list, the Private Lives book and then Einstein in Love, which is a charming book by Dennis Overby. Isaacson, as does the Private Lives book, talks a great deal about Einstein's women and the fact that Einstein, in his personal life, remained married to Mileva technically until 1918. But in fact, as he was moving around, and again, if you look at how he's moving around, you see what kind of reputation Albert Einstein achieved very, very quickly as a young man by the time he was in his late 20s. I mean, it was remarkable. In the Baron, he worked at the patent office for a while. They were married while, you know, he was working there. Once he got his qualification to teach in a university, he taught at the University of Bern. He then, very soon after that, had an opportunity to teach elsewhere. And on your handout, yeah, I have that listed. So that he was a privat docent, which is sort of like being an unpaid professor, basically. And then he became technically what we would call an associate professor at the University of Zurich. So he started out at the University of Bern. Then he went to the University of Zurich. Then he got an offer at the University of Prague, the German-speaking university in Prague. Then he got an offer at Zurich Polytechnic, where he'd gotten his degree. And then he got an offer in Berlin, at the University of Berlin. All of that happened between 1905 and 1914. I mean, really remarkable. He could have anything he wanted. He was getting offers in the United States already by that time. His offer in Berlin was an offer to take a position at the University of Berlin at the rank of regular professor, which is a big deal, without any obligation to teach. And he never taught. He also was given a membership in the Berlin Academy of Sciences, which carried a salary and a lot of prestige. And that was important. He also was given in 1914, directorship of an institute for theoretical physics in Berlin that did not exist. It was a paper institution. He got a salary for directing it. It wasn't actually built until the late 1930s after he had settled in the United States. So, I mean, this is a man who in 1914, he was at the top of the heap in physics. And he could do anything he wanted, go anywhere, and he had all the time to do whatever he pleased. However, his wife, Mileva, did not want to leave Switzerland. She didn't want to go to Berlin. And he had some reservations about going to Berlin. In fact, without going into the details, but you can read them in the book, he had renounced his German citizenship and taken up Swiss citizenship in 1900. And he only reluctantly retook German citizenship after the end of the First World War, and then he renounced it again in 1933. He kept his Swiss citizenship all through his life, from 1900 until he died. He became a U.S. citizen in 1940, so he did hold that double citizenship at the end of his life. So in 1914, when he was going to Berlin, Mileva did not want to go with him. And by this time, he already had, in fact, begun a relationship with his first cousin, Elsa, who lived in Berlin. And as it turned out, although Mileva brought the two boys with her to Berlin, and they stayed in Berlin very briefly, they went back to Switzerland, and they never lived with him in Berlin. He and his first wife were divorced, and then he married his first cousin, Elsa, who had two daughters, and he was very close to those two daughters. He did, as Isaacson talks about a great deal, have a number of liaisons through the course of his life, and I won't enumerate them, but you can read about them, not in detail, but just, you know, sort of names and dates and that kind of thing, through the course of his life. Is that interesting? One of the most interesting things about it, I think, is this. Lee Smolin, who is a physicist, has written a review of Isaacson's book and has written about Einstein himself. And I rather like what Lee Smolin said. He said, you know, so many people think about physicists, particularly theoretical physicists, as being sort of out-of-body nerds. And, you know, certainly Einstein betrays the stereotype. This was not well known in his lifetime. Why should it be? And the press pays a lot more attention to this kind of thing now, as we all know, the personal relationships of political men and women, than they used to. They used to leave it alone. But in any case, Einstein did have many relationships. His wife Elsa knew about most of them, and he even, proposed a ménage à trois at one point, which she wasn't keen on. But there is, again, I think that maybe the important there are several interesting things about this. But one is that it does show that Einstein was someone for whom the mind was not all. In any case, another interesting point is that there was a perception. Now when we look at Einstein, we look at usually these pictures of him, the bohemian figure, the wild hair, usually the older Einstein. And, this is the stereotype of him. And there's a stereotype of him as being childlike, as if all theoretical physicists are just children at heart. Otherwise, why would they ask the kind of questions they do, and, why would they behave the way they do, et cetera. But, in fact, Einstein, when he was a young man, was regarded by women as being sensual, as being very attractive, as being, a really interesting man. And he always, all through his life, had women who were interested in him. One aspect of this may simply be that aspect, which is creativity and genius and that sort of thing, which certainly has its own appeal. But there also was something in Einstein that biographers, including Isaacson, have commented on, that sort of called women to mother him, to sort of want to manage him. And, there was something about him that was a little childlike, I suppose, in a way that did appeal to some women. He also, at the end of his life, in fact, surrounded himself by women in the sense that his wife, Elsa, died in 1936. He didn't die until 1955. And at the end of his life, he had three women who were living with him at his house in Princeton. All perfectly legitimate. One was his secretary, Helen Dukost, with whom he did not have an intimate relationship. It was a professional and, a friendly relationship, but it was not sexually intimate. One of his stepdaughters lived with him, and his sister, younger sister, came to live with him in the latter years of her life. So this was a household in which there were three women and Albert Einstein. And at the same time, he was having relationships with other women in Princeton. One of whom, and this is interesting, one of whom, as it turns out, he was having a relationship in the late 1940s, and it turns out she was, in fact, a Russian spy. She lived in Greenwich Village. Her husband was a sculptor. She did work for Russian intelligence, and she did have a relationship with Albert Einstein. She got sent back, she returned to Moscow, I think it was 1952, I don't remember exactly, and they corresponded a little bit, and she encouraged him to come visit, and he never did. What's so interesting about this is that he had been under investigation by the FBI since 1931. The first letter sent to the FBI about Albert Einstein was sent when he was in California and in the United States in 1931. A woman who was a member of something called the Women Patriots League wrote I doubt if she typed it herself, but there was a 16-page typed memo that she sent to the FBI protesting this German foreigner's pacifism, socialism, and anti-Germanism, and saying that he should never be issued a visa to this country again. And she offered this huge list of things that had been said about him or that she had overheard or read about him, et cetera, why he should not come. In 1940, J. Edgar Hoover advised the U.S. Army and the military that under no circumstances should Albert Einstein be given security clearance, that he was a known socialist, probably a communist sympathizer, member of a lot of communist organizations, and he should not be given security clearance. This, of course, is the Albert Einstein who, among other things, as many of you know and as you can read about in Isaacson's biography, signed a letter famously that was given to him by Leo Szilard and Eugene Figner in Princeton in the summer of 1939, the destination of which was President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, in order to warn Roosevelt that the Germans, in fact, were pioneering work in nuclear fission, and that the Germans had moved into Czechoslovakia where there were uranium ores, and that the United States needed to be prepared for an atomic bomb to be built by Germany. In any case, Hoover thought that Einstein couldn't be trusted. And during the days of the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Senate McCarthy hearings, McCarthy had a file in which he listed Einstein as a member of, I think it's 34 subversive organizations, but conceded in his report that he could not prove that Einstein was a communist. However, the FBI never knew that the woman he was having an affair with in the late 1940s was really a Russian spy. I just think it's wonderful. In Isaacson's biography, one of the things that he does is to discuss the way in which Einstein became famous, not only for his scientific work, but also his relationships with the press. And this is really, really interesting, because what it shows is that Albert Einstein was not simply naive victim of the press. In fact, he was pretty canny about giving interviews to the press, about controlling the press. And there were a lot of good reasons for doing this. But then there were also, his relationship with the press brought him under criticism for a lot of people. Without going into too many details, because we don't have time, and I want to bring this to a close, and then if those you want some questions, we can have some. But Albert Einstein, for a number of reasons, found himself being under physical threat of violence as early as the 1920s in Germany. And a good deal of this was anti-Semitism, but it was an anti-Semitism that was directed to him because he was becoming famous, because his theories were on the front page of newspapers, particularly after the 1919 expeditions confirmed the general theory of relativity. And he was identified, you know, publicly by his legitimate opponents in the physics community, but also by troublemakers who were anti-Semitic, as being someone who was a Jewish physicist doing abstract physics, it was said, not the kind of experimental physics, it was said, that should be or had been characteristic of German physics. Now, I mean, we won't go into the charges. We don't have time. But, I mean, they don't make any sense. When you deconstruct them, it's just, you know, the inconsistencies are incredible. But in any case, he found himself being physically threatened. And he also initially attempted, although some of his scientist colleagues advised him against it, to defend himself and to defend his theories in the press. And that's one of the reasons he went to the press, one of the reasons he did public appearances. And he wrote popular books on general relativity theory and special theory of relativity, too. That got him more attention. And then it sort of snowballs, because on one hand, he made himself accessible to the press. On the other hand, some of the attention he was getting from the press then caused him to become more a victim, or at least an object, let's say, of threats and intimidation. In addition, he himself never was a passionate Zionist, but he became more and more sympathetic to Zionism over the course of his lifetime for a lot of good reasons. And he also cultivated relationships with the press, partly on behalf of the Return to Palestine movement among some of his friends who were active in that movement. And indeed, his first trip to the United States in 1921, when he first dealt with the U.S. press, was one in which, among other things, he was part of a campaign to raise money for the Zionist cause. And Einstein's wife, Elsa, at that point in 1921, although she didn't consistently do this, she began charging for photographs of Einstein. And the money went to the Zionist cause. That's what she did. A lot of people were, as I say, critical of Einstein for his familiarity with the press. When he was in California in the 1930s, He became a friend of Charlie Chaplin. He got on with Upton Sinclair, whose campaign for the California governorship brought communist charges against Upton Sinclair. And Robert Millikan, who was head of Caltech at the time, very important physicist, kept trying to get Einstein to back off talking to the press, going to Hollywood extravaganzas, and palling around with these Hollywood bigwigs. Another thing that happened with regard to the press and the publicity is that he did go to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in 1933. Abraham Flexner was the director of that institute. Oppenheimer would later become the director of it. Flexner was very unhappy with the way in which Einstein was being courted by the press and giving interviews all the time. And, you know, photographers and journalists and whatnot were coming to Princeton, and Flexner did not like it at all. Flexner, when he was getting nowhere by telling Einstein to stop, and this I'd never read before, I saw it in Isaacson's book, Flexner began intercepting Einstein's mail. And among the letters that he intercepted in 1934 was a letter to Einstein from, I'm not sure if actually it was from President Roosevelt himself or it was from Eleanor Roosevelt, but it was a letter inviting Elsa and Albert to the White House. And when the White House didn't get a reply, they made a phone call. And Einstein discovered he'd never gotten the letter. He and Flexner had a falling out over this, and they did not remain close in later years. And Einstein wrote one letter to a friend, as Isaacson mentions, where on the return address, Einstein put, you know, A.E., Concentration Camp Princeton. So, I mean, Einstein himself, he didn't back off. He would not back off the contacts with the press, and he kept on with them. A couple more things, and then I'll stop, and we can open it up to questions. Einstein frequently was asked about his religious views, and I don't think I will reiterate those now. We can talk about that a little bit later if some of you want to. Journalists, again, over and over again, ask him, you know, what do you believe, what do you believe? And the most famous comment that he made that I'll just will mention is in response to a rabbi who sent him a telegram and asked if Einstein would respond, this is an American rabbi, asked him if he would respond in 50 words about his religious belief. Einstein sent back a 25-word statement that became famous, in which he said that he believed in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the lawful harmony of all that exists, but not in a God who concerns himself with the fate and doings of mankind. So he believed in order. He did not believe in an anthropomorphic God. He did not believe in personal immortality. I do want to mention this. In the United States, he found himself confronting American racism against African Americans. And he wrote an essay on what he called, this was common at the time, the Negro question. He was very concerned, and he was concerned about witnessing, laws and rules, both legal and informal, against African Americans in this country. When Marian Anderson, the great contralto, came to Princeton to do a concert in 1937, I don't know how many of you may have been in Princeton in the last years, but a very famous place to stay in Princeton was the place to stay in 1937, the Nassau End. And Marian Anderson went to the Nassau End to ask for a room. She was turned down. And when Einstein found out about this, he offered her a room in his house on Mercer Street. And when Marian Anderson came back to Princeton every year, every time afterwards, up until shortly before his death, she stayed with Albert Einstein. In addition, he very seldom accepted, and even more seldom, went to a university to receive an honorary degree. But he did go to a black university, Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and he received an honorary doctoral degree there from this black institution. And that on that occasion, he met the six-year-old son of the university's president. The six-year-old boy was Julian Bond. And these are very important stories that Isaacson tells. Finally, regarding the Red Scare, Isaacson spends a good deal of time talking about Einstein's pacifism, about his affiliation with many groups that had... Einstein was someone who really argued for a world government and for world government control of military forces in order to eliminate warfare. And he believed in that passionately. He also became an activist of sorts against atomic weapons after the Second World War. And he took many of these stands. He did become a subject of investigation, as I've said, by the FBI. He also was often asked by friends what they should do when they were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee or the McCarthy Committee. And his advice to them usually was not to take the Fifth Amendment, but to take the First Amendment, and to aggressively declare that we all have free speech. When Robert Oppenheimer was brought before the Atomic Energy Commission's board in 1954 and relieved of his security clearance, Einstein initially advised Oppenheimer very forcefully, and this is just 1 year before Einstein's death, he advised Oppenheimer not to fight the case. I won't go into the technicalities of it, but basically Einstein's opinion was the opinion of a lot of Oppenheimer's colleagues. Fundamentally, you're a giant, they're pygmies. Don't let them bring you down. But Oppenheimer didn't pay heed to that advice, and he went ahead and submitted himself to this what became an interrogation rather than just a hearing. And afterwards, Einstein discovered that some people at the Institute for Advanced Study, some people were saying Oppenheimer shouldn't continue as director there. And Einstein was the one who went around and talked to colleagues and ended up helping to get the signature of every member of the Institute for Advanced Study in support of Oppenheimer's continuing as director at the Institute, which, again, I think is something very important to say about him. Finally, Isaacson's biography of Einstein portrays him, as so many biographies do, as a lone revolutionary. Well, he was a revolutionary, but he was also conservative, and he was certainly conservative in his physics. One could say after 1927, he was very conservative. And the younger generation in physics, many members of the younger generation, people like Werner Heisenberg, people a little bit less young like Niels Bohr, often got very impatient with Einstein for his resistance to many of the new theories in physics. Another younger generation in physics got very impatient with Einstein because Einstein devoted his last years, by which I mean 20 or 30 years, to what he called the quest for unified field theory, and many of the younger physicists felt that he had abandoned general relativity theory, and that general relativity theory became a kind of fringe discipline in physics for many years, and it didn't need to have turned out that way. Was he a revolutionary? Was he conservative? He was a maverick. And Isaacson gives you lots of indications of that. I mean, he was a maverick. He did not have the disposition of a joiner. He did not have the disposition of someone who was easily intimidated or who was easily made to cooperate, even. His family sometimes suffered from that, as his friends sometimes suffered from it, and as did his colleagues. Was he lone? I don't know. Abraham Pice writes about him that in Einstein's published work over his lifetime, he had 31 collaborators. So he had 31 people who worked with him and who either co-authored papers or did work with him or in some cases co-wrote a book or two with him. So he wasn't alone in that sense. He didn't have, as I mentioned earlier, he didn't teach and he didn't have students. So he was alone in that sense. Maybe that makes him a maverick too. In the end, we have our stereotypes of Einstein, and I don't think they're easy to overturn. He was a complicated man, and he was not a disembodied man, as scientists are not disembodied people. This particular biography, I think, does a very good job of giving us a sense of Einstein's life, what was important to him, how he lived his life, the strengths and weaknesses of the man, and the strengths and weaknesses of some of his later work, in particular in physics. So I highly recommend the book to you. And now that it's in paperback, maybe it won't be quite as heavy, and it'll be a little bit less expensive. So I'm glad to entertain questions or comments. It is after the hour now, and some of you, I think, have places you have to go and things you want to do. Thank you very much. I do also want to mention, someone gave me some information about the film, the PBS film, which is available for purchase, Albert Einstein, How I See the World, and the fact that Linus Pauling is one of the many people who appears in that film. And I have information here about the film if any of you want to know how to get it. Yeah, John.
Well, I have three questions. You can address any one you want. One was the general receptivity of the 1905 papers at that time. The second one is, what was the true motivation for him leaving Germany? And the third one was, what was his role in the development of the atomic bomb?
Well,
don't try to answer all three, just pick one.
His motivation for leaving Germany was not of his own making. And Einstein had, I mentioned earlier that he was under death threats and a lot of criticism in Germany. Many people worried about his personal safety. On the whole, he downplayed that himself. He took a lot of chances in the 1920s he probably shouldn't have taken in terms of public appearances, and ended up not suffering from that physically. He, in the early 1930s, the city of Berlin decided they wanted to make a gift to him. Everybody knew that he liked to sail, as he did when he came to the United States, and they wanted to make a gift to him of a plot of land and a residence at a little town called Kapuf, which would put him near the water. That became a major political problem for the city because there was so much criticism of making this gift to this Jewish person. And he was going back and forth to the United States. He liked a lot of things about the United States, but of course not everything. And Millikan was trying to get him to come to Caltech, and he worked out a deal that he could split his time between Berlin and Pasadena. At the same time, Flexner was trying to get him to come full-time, no half-time deal, to the Institute for Advanced Study. And so Einstein knew he had that. He was either in the United States or in Belgium when Adolf Hitler was appointed chancellor in January of 1933, and he never went back. He decided he would accept Flexner, and of course, again, when I say he never went back, let me just be specific about this. When Hitler came into power in January of 1933, there was a couple of months in which people thought that the National Socialists, as it was often said, would have to moderate their policies now that they were in power. They'd have to become pragmatic. They didn't. They staged the Reichstag fire, and then in April of 1933, laws were passed that were civil service laws that required the firing of all public employees, all state employees who were Jewish or certain other categories, unless they had done military service in the First World War. And then that stipulation was dropped. But in any case, technically, Albert Einstein was a public employee. He was a professor at the University of Berlin. And that made him, like OSU, professors or employees of the state of Oregon, he was an employee of the government. So he would have lost his job. And, of course, he nor anyone else knew just how bad things would get. But he knew that he would lose his position and he would no longer be able to stay in Germany. And he also knew that many of his colleagues who were Jewish were having to leave. And so he wouldn't have that sort of core of friends and colleagues that he'd had previously. In the end, he resigned his position, and the Berlin Academy of Sciences, many of the members were furious because they were taking a vote to expel him from the Berlin Academy of Sciences, and he resigned before they could expel him. They expelled him anyway, but he'd actually written a letter of resignation before the formal expulsion. So he was very glad to come to the United States, and he didn't go back to Europe. Yeah.
Would you clarify how 1914 is a threshold year? Was Einstein a lot less mobile at the time, 1914?
You mean did Einstein become less mobile because he took the position in Berlin?
You mentioned 1914 as a very special year. It sets apart something.
Oh, why was I emphasizing 1914? I emphasized 1914 as the year that Einstein made the decision to go back to Germany. At that point, he had a plum position at Zurich Polytechnic Institute. His wife, Mileva, and his children were very happy in Switzerland. They liked Zurich a lot. But he had been to a couple of conferences recently in Brussels, the Solvay Physics conferences, and had really impressed personally some powerful German physicists, in particular Max Planck, Walter Nernst, Max von Laue, and others, Fritz Haber, who was a physical chemist, and they came to him and made him this offer to go to Berlin in 1914. And his decision to accept that offer is a major turning point in his life, personally and professionally, going back to Germany, and politically, that decision. And one of the things, of course, that he didn't anticipate when he moved back to Germany in 1914 was the outbreak of the war in August of 1914. And he found himself in Germany then during the First World War, and he had always been, from the time he was a small boy, an anti-militarist. He had never intended to serve in the German army. That's one of the reasons he went to Switzerland. And during the war, he was one of four people who signed a pacifist anti-war manifesto. And that's another reason I forgot to mention, that he became the subject of a lot of political vendettas at the end of the First World War when the Germans lost. Anything else?
Yeah. Does Isis say anything about these eclipse expeditions?
Does Isaacson say anything about the eclipse expeditions? Yes, he does. And he gives a nice account of how it is that that Einstein was working on what came to be called the general theory of relativity beginning in 1907, and that he had in 1913 something that later came to be called a sketch of a general relativity theory, and that Einstein really put a lot of pressure on his friend Erwin Freundlich, who was an astronomer, to test Einstein's general relativity theory in 1914 in Russia, when an eclipse would take place where the full eclipse would have a path across over Russia. And Freundlich went to Russia in order to do that, but again, the war broke out in August of 1914, and Freundlich and his equipment were all sequestered as, you know, foreign enemies. And it took Freundlich a while to get back to Germany. As it turned out, the version of Einstein's theory in 1914 was a version that was faulty. And had Freundlich or some others attempted to confirm the theory in 1914, they would have failed to confirm it, because Einstein's predictions of the bending of starlight were in fact wrong at that point. Einstein knew there was a problem with the theory, because that 1913-14 version of it was one that did not give him the proper number for a well-known phenomenon that has to do with Mercury's orbit around the sun. And so Einstein knew there was a bit of a problem with the theory, and then he kept on reworking it. And in 1915, he got the theory that was confirmed in 1919. Yeah?
From what you know from reading about him, do you think he would have been a good teacher?
Do I think he would have been a good teacher? You know, I can't predict that. I mean, one of the sort of, certainly one of the most influential physicists of all time, as I don't know if you'd say as a teacher, but let's say a teacher, certainly as a mentor, was Niels Bohr. And he was famous for just mumbling, you know. But, you know, what people said about him was, it wasn't his presentations, it was just sitting down and talking with him. So Einstein as a lecturer for 300 people, well, again, I don't know. I mean, you know, he could be a bit, he was a showman. I mean, maybe he would have, but he didn't want to put his time into that. So I don't know the answer. I mean, there are different kinds of teachers, and I don't know. Now, some people who, you know, have met, I mean, I never met Einstein, and I've seen, you know, recordings of interviews with him and that kind of thing. There are people who are better qualified and could answer your question, I think, and I don't know how to do it. Yeah, sir.
You said he was very good at dealing with the media. How do you think he felt about being a celebrity of science?
He was good with dealing with the media. How did he feel about being a celebrity of science? I think that a lot of the time he enjoyed it. Do you mean how did he think it was important that someone be a celebrity for science? Probably so.
Because of the strong need to this day of science literacy.
Yeah, I mean, he did write a lot of popular books. I mean, he really did try to reach the public, and he did try to reach students, young people, in that respect. He was very, very, very good at coming up with, and some of you may have read some of these sort of examples of how to think about relativity theory, how to think about motion and relative motion and the speed of light and that kind of thing. He gave very good examples, had a knack for it. So he could express his views in a way that was engaging and easy for young people as well as for older people to understand. And so I think he did value that role. He was aware, of course, that many of his colleagues thought he was overdoing publicity and that he was turning himself into an icon, and many people criticized him for that. So, but he made his choices, and he made them self-consciously. Yeah.
One reason I asked you about the teaching was if he was seen as conservative in his later years. I think with some teachers, they become less conservative because the students kind of bring them along and ask questions that generate new thoughts. And if he didn't teach, maybe that was one of the reasons that he didn't kind of keep up with how things were going.
That's a very good point. And the point is that since he was not teaching, he was not putting himself in contact sort of routinely with young people who have new ideas and who question you and who, you know, sort of force you into going along with the new ideas. That could be important. Irv?
On that point, though, when I was at Princeton, Einstein at the Institute was interacting with the Princeton faculty. So he was interacting particularly with John Wheeler and Barton, mm-hmm. then with some of the younger faculty. So he was in contact with, if not graduate students, people right at the beginning of their career. He wasn't just isolated, although there was this famous saying, what was it, that he was a landmark rather than a searchlight or something like that. And in his later years, he was this monument, but he wasn't really doing much of anything for physics.
Irv, who is a physicist, was saying that he had seen Einstein at Princeton and that had observed, as people knew, that Einstein was interacting with younger physicists at the time, and particularly John Wheeler, who just passed away in April and who's one of the great American theoretical physicists and who greatly admired Einstein. Didn't always agree with him, but admired him. Gene?
Could I recommend a couple books that you didn't have on your list?
You certainly may. More book recommendations.
I'm recommending some books that I didn't have on the list. First one is Einstein in America by Jamie Sayen, S-A-Y-E-N. And the other one is Einstein on Peace, edited by Nathan and Norton. That one's rather older, but they're both wonderful books that you're not going to, you're going to get more perspective than you're getting anything else.
Thanks, Gene. One of the books I have on the list that's edited by David Rowe and Robert Shulman, I particularly recommend, on Einstein and Politics. It's a selection of Einstein's writings with introductions. Shulman has been on the Einstein Project, so I mean, he worked with the Einstein papers. And David Rowe is an American who's teaching at the University of Mainz in Germany and who does the history of mathematics and the history of German physics and mathematics, and it's a very fine selection that really, as a recent book on Einstein's politics, is superb. Yes, Jim?
We know that Pauling interacted some with Einstein, and they developed a relationship, and certainly Pauling must have been seen by Einstein as a person much in his own mold, something great scientist and then becoming very active politically and socially. Did Isaacson put much in his book about the relationship between those two, or was it?
I don't think so. In fact, I'm just thinking now, I should look at the index and see just what he says about Linus Pauling. I mean, Pauling, of course, was a member of the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, of which Einstein was technically the chair, although Szilard was doing all of the legwork. And Linus Pauling, as you say, admired Einstein enormously. Let me look to see what I can remember. Indexes are often very helpful. Ah, he has just one mention of Pauling. And that seems to be in a foot. That can't be right. In a footnote. Six.
Well, I can't find it right now, but it's just a mention of Einstein in a chapter that has to do with the Emergency Committee on Atomic Scientists. Yeah, Sarah?
Well, was there any mention of Richard Feynman, any interaction between Feynman and Einstein?
I think there is a mention of Feynman, but I may be confusing that with something else that I read recently. Okay, page 515. Let's see if it turns up there. Oh, all right, well, this ties in with Irv's point. Another colleague who tried and failed to convert Einstein was John Wheeler, Princeton University's renowned theoretical physicist. One afternoon, he came by Mercer Street to explain a new approach to quantum theory, known as the sum over histories approach. Known as the sum over histories approach that he was developing with his graduate student, Richard Feynman. So Wheeler's graduate student. And Wheeler said, I had gone to Einstein with the hope to persuade him of the naturalness of the quantum theory when seen in this new light, Wheeler recalled. Einstein listened patiently for 20 minutes, but when it was over, repeated his familiar refrain, I still cannot believe that the good Lord plays dice. Wheeler showed his disappointment, and Einstein softened his pronouncement slightly. Of course, I may be wrong, he said in a slow and humorous cadence.
Wheeler was always done.
Yeah. One more question. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Is there anything about Einstein's childhood and how he was as a young student? Because there are all sorts of sayings about.
Yes, I mean, there is a discussion of Einstein's childhood, and he was born in Ulm, and is growing up in Munich, and his going to school along with his sister, and then the circumstances under which he left when he was in his teen years to go to Milan, actually, where his father and his uncle had gone to set up a new electrical engineering firm. And there's some discussion of that, a little bit about his schoolwork, and a little bit about his early reading and his playing of the violin and his musicality. One more question. You had a question.
The one world government, you're talking about Einstein wanting the future of the world to be, and there was the attempt with language. I think he said one world language as well, and Esperanto, mm-hmm. My father, his Marine Corps friend, could speak and write in it. Has there been any more attempts with some great world language possibility to get us talking together before we kill each other so much?
I'm not sure where the Esperanto movement stands right now.
This very entirely new thing, like logical, like computer developed, and instead of, you know, in caves as well, all languages.
I guess music is still all we've got.
Okay.
Thank you so very much.